According to Steve's paper, you said this, Marie, that the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission was established in 1977, and it was established by whaling captains from each of the nine villages coming together and constituting themselves the commission and saying, okay, we've got to do something about this. And you went ahead and did it. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to do. But did anybody say to you, well, where is your legal mandate? Where's the state law that says you can talk to us? Where's the federal law? Show us your credentials. Give us a piece of paper. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I guess it's just part of self-determination that we consider ourselves United States citizens, and we have as much right as anybody else to say how we feel to the government and take some initiative. That's, you know, I think that we didn't even consider that. I mean, I don't think people even thought or asked themselves that question.
Well, I didn't think so, but Tony Vasca.
Thank you. I suspect that it's probably easy to generalize and say that I think most of us who have had to deal with a variety of management agencies have had to own up to credentials. And Marie is correct in saying that, yes, there is a forum to allow us to come and tell people, managing agents or agencies, what it is exactly that we want. And in observing the different forums that operate, whether it's the migratory caribou or the whales or the birds, the public process that is allowed by the federal or state governments allows for people to get together. That exists now, I think, in state and federal laws. I think what is probably more interesting is the fact that you have all of the whaling captains willing to sit down as a group, a single group, to manage that specific species. You'll probably find the same thing with the caribou, certainly with the birds. It was in the interest of the users to get together to meet with the managing agencies. And those managing agencies are numerous. If I tried to outline who the whalers had to deal with before they got results, they had to deal with the International Whaling Commission, the State Department, Commerce Department, and Interior Department. And I know it's real difficult to trust the State Department when the State Department perhaps has never been in the North Slope to do their own observations, and yet it is that department that's negotiating on behalf of the Alaska Eskimos on that specific issue. I think we face the same thing with migratory birds. We spend a lot of time training, teaching the State Department and Interior Department about exactly what it is we want. And one of the adaptations, or one of the strategies we use, is to learn and use what systems are available to continue doing what we want to do. And it's a real slow process, and Burton is correct. The research done by the different state and federal agencies do follow a system, and that system sometimes is not only unwieldy, it's very slow. And whales don't wait for the scientists to finish their research, and neither do the people who hunt them. Excuse me. Also, one other thing that shouldn't be forgotten in terms of the technology, I was asking a question hoping for a certain response, and that is, when you talk about customary and traditional users and technologies, you have to also remember that technologies evolve, and the use of those technologies should be considered as part of the methods and means that subsistence users use to harvest whatever species they're after.
You're making the point that Mr. Gross made, that these cultures and their technologies evolve and change, and they shouldn't be frozen at...
I have a better chance of bagging a goose with a shotgun than I do with a ball. I guarantee that.
David Case, Steve Benke. Go ahead, Steve.
Mr. Chairman, there have been a number of comments about the term customer traditional, and I just wanted to point out that in the state law, I think that certainly it can be interpreted, people can interpret that to mean that it potentially could lock people into things, but it doesn't have to mean that. I mean, obviously, you know, it's a political process, and I think that so far there haven't. I can't think of any situations where the Board of Game or the Board of Fisheries have tried to lock in and prevent modification or change in those along those lines. There may be cases I haven't thought of, but thus far I think that the boards have been amenable to seeing that. In fact, in some cases they've tried to encourage changes sort of along the lines you're talking about to improve efficiency. In which case, I think appropriately, local people have pointed out that it may not make very good sense to try and use crab pots in Norton Sound. That they prefer their lines through the ice. That they're a lot more practical. But
David Case.
I have a question and then maybe a comment, and this relates to Judge Berger's question, I think. Has the Whaling Commission found it necessary or advisable to organize under some formal state structure or other kind of structure?
We have incorporated as an association, and also we have an arm. We've incorporated as there's a nonprofit arm to be able to channel funds to operate the Whaling Commission, but the organization itself is an association.
And that is association chartered under the laws of the state of Alaska?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
For the purposes of operations, not otherwise.
Okay.
David?
Well, one perhaps it's obvious, but I'd like to see if there's any response on your part. It seems to me that the Whaling Commission is quite a startling development, really, in terms of the involvement of Aboriginal people in international negotiations. I wonder if you agree with that, that the fact that Aboriginal people, whether you are sitting wherever you can negotiating with the federal government and then with the IWC, is that the fact that it appears to be that you're doing it directly in the international arena and not going through government instruments of the United States government.
The United States government does not have any problem. They haven't had any problem, and the conservationists don't feel that it is a problem to be representing ourselves in dealing with all levels that we have to deal with related to our subsistence take. I hadn't seen that, except the thing that we've gone through is when people don't listen, the native people tend to walk out. I mean, they've walked out a couple of times out of the International Whaling Commission meetings.
Steve Langdon.
I want to make, Marie, maybe you can clarify this, because one of my understandings is that one of the court cases is still pending, and that court case asserts that the AEWC does not recognize the jurisdiction of the federal government. And so that we are in a pragmatic regime here. Basically, we're on hold as long as the federal government proceeds with a regime that's more or less in the keeping with the, what the Inupiat people expect, they'll go along with it. But if the federal government should try to impose a complete ban, then the AEWC would withdraw from their necessary commitment to the federal regime as it's established. Maybe it's unfair to make that kind of statement, but and if you don't want to comment on it, that's fine.
The court case you're talking about, I just recently talked with our attorneys who represent the Whaling Commission. That case has been set aside by the court, dismissed with prejudice, that we can bring it back up in case that we wanted to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's 12 sharp, and I think, I'd like to thank Marie Adams and Burton Rexford for explaining the work of the Whaling Commission. Steve's paper, this long paper, beginning at page 43, has a discussion of the Whaling Commission, so that is a good background, and I recommend it to you. This afternoon, we'll begin the discussion at 1, if you would be able to, if you would come back at 1, we'll start again, and we'll begin the discussion of the International Porcupine Caribou Commission, and that will take us, I think, from Fort Yukon and Venati across the international boundary into Yukon territory, and we'll hear from all of those people this afternoon. So we'll adjourn till 1 then.
Could you give me 5 minutes to make a framing comment about the range of the regulation?
This afternoon?
Yeah, just to sure. Lead it in. Yeah, I just want to give people a sense of what the range of these things are.
You speak to Jonathan and tell him that you want to come ahead of him.
Okay.
You're bigger than he is.
Well, it was a good morning.
Yeah.
One thing you might consider is actually putting Langdon's paper as part of the record, since people refer to it so much.
Well,
I know whether you want to mention this.
Yeah.
Or not.
Sure. I
could just have it as a step.
Well, shall we take our seats?
The Alaska Humanities Forum is here on mass until 3, so you just might welcome them.
They are. Right?
Yeah, the whole.
Well, we had a very useful discussion yesterday about basic issues bearing on subsistence, moral and economic and cultural. And this morning we considered the first of a series of specific initiatives that Native people are taking to preserve their subsistence way of life. The discussion of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, I think we all agree, was very, very interesting. This afternoon, we're going to begin with a discussion of the International Porcupine Caribou Commission, an international Native Peoples Commission established to preserve the subsistence way of life of the villages in Canada and the U.S. that depend on the porcupine caribou herd. And what I thought we would do this afternoon would be, first of all, to ask Steve Langdon to frame the whole picture for us. Then we'll ask Jonathan Solomon to discuss the Porcupine Caribou Commission, and Bob Childers will assist him, I think, if he is back in time to do so. And then, since it is an international concern, we will ask Victor Matander of Council of Yukon Indians, Hugh Monahan of the Northwest Territorial Government, and Bob Gamble of Parks Canada to discuss the corresponding measures taken on the Canadian side of the border with regard to subsistence. So, by the way, we have a number of guests today, as we did yesterday, and today they include the members of the State Board of the Alaska Humanities Forum, which I wish to welcome. They have given a good deal of support to this commission, and we're grateful to them for that. Well, Steve, would you like to start?
Thank you, Justice Berger. What I would simply like to do here is to present a few framing remarks about the range of the new institutions that Alaska Native peoples have began developing in the last decade, what some of their intentions with these new organizations are, and some of the principles upon which they're based. These new organizations are more formal in the sense of structure and process than have been the ways in which Alaska Native peoples have traditionally governed subsistence. But they all seek to incorporate aspects of traditional management, including local control, the utilization of kinship systems, the utilization, as Marie spoke this morning, of local knowledge as part of the new management regime. But they are also seeking out and reaching out for the new sources of information that can be presented by new kinds of scientific and technological apparatus. However, Native peoples want to control that scientific process so that it produces information which is relevant to the protection of the resources upon which subsistence is dependent, as well as the protection of the subsistence use of those resources. I guess my fundamental point there that I want to make is that as I see the new institutions, they involve the incorporation of traditional principles and taking new kinds of approaches that are relevant to those traditional principles and bringing them into the new formal organizations as well. These organizations have emerged as Alaska Natives have been threatened by state and federal and international forces, with the denial or severe limitations being placed on subsistence activities. The aims of the organizations, as you will see, are somewhat different, and we can begin to piece together some overall understandings about them as each of the cases emerge from the participants presenting them. But they share the desire and will to be involved more directly, more fundamentally in the decisions and management of the resources they depend on. Many indeed are oriented to Native self-management of regulations on harvest levels and harvesting practices. Many are conceive of themselves as fundamentally advisory in nature. Others conceive of themselves as fundamentally self-management in nature. These bodies vary in their length of existence, their complexity, the organizations in terms of communities, regional associations that comprise the membership, and they vary in the relationships which they've established with the state institutions, with the federal government, and with international organizations. We heard yesterday from Tony Vasca and Harold Spark about the Hooper Bay Waterfowl Agreement, which has a specific set of characteristics and understandings. We heard this morning from Marie Adams about the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. We'll also hear from Jonathan shortly on the International Porcupine Caribou Commission. We will hear from Caleb and perhaps Matthew Aya tomorrow on the Eskimo Rawlers Commission. And in addition, there are other kinds of new initiatives being taken in the area of Alaska Native self-regulation, initiatives that are rising out of the Indian Reorganization Act, the tribal governance system of the federal government. And tomorrow we will also hear from Nana and from Norton Sound on IRA initiatives in the area of regulation of subsistence. I think we all agree and are excited by the potentials of the new directions, and we should also be very cognizant of the fruit, the very useful fruit that have been born in the path-setting efforts by the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission in this regard, and the new Hooper Bay Waterfowl Agreement. I believe that there is the great possibility for more fruit to be born with effort and nurturance in these areas. This is not to say that there aren't hard questions and hard negotiations and even battles in the future to be waged on these fronts. And with that, Justice Berger, I turn it back over to you and get off, John.
Well, Jonathan Solomon. There. I hope so.
My name is Jonathan Solomon. I'm the chief of the Yukon Flat People. The organization name of that is the Kuchakuchinginhi. All it means in the English term is that the Yukon Flat People speak. This organization was incorporated as a tribal sovereignty nation in the early 60s when our good friend Senator Gruening proposed to build a big monument for himself called the Rampart Dam. This organization fought that thing on an equal basis with the senator, and we won. And then along come 1971 land claims, and we were quite involved in it. In 1971, after Nixon signed it, we thought we were done. So we went back home to the Yukon Flat, and we started living our life as we used to. And all of a sudden, under the land claims, came up what is known as the public interest land will be decided for the state of Alaska. And in that, at the Marine Fishery Committee, Congressman Don Young proposed oil development in the Arctic Wildlife Range. Immediately, the Kuchakuchinki people came up in their arms with the congressman. And I was called as the chief to lead the fight against oil development on the Arctic Wildlife Range. At that point in time, in 75, we said that the porcupine caribou herd must survive. And we knew that we couldn't do it alone. So we called upon our Canadian brothers to join us because the porcupine caribou herd was an international animal. And that was the first time we ever met, and we only called upon our brothers across the border at Old Crow. Immediately, we went to Washington, D.C. to testify against oil development on the in the Arctic Wildlife Range, especially the calving area. At that time, we also called our Eskimo brothers in Katuvik to join us in this, because the calving ground of the Porcupine Caribou herd is in the back door of the Katuvik Village Corporations. And that's how it all started. And we became the political football of the public interest lands called D2 lands. But we had to come down and we negotiated a position on the development of the Arctic Wildlife Range. And then we started meeting with our Canadian brothers on both sides to make sure that all these things take place. But as you know, the people that we elect to direct our country, how natural resources and how economic development should occur in this country, always at the end, we as rural Alaskan people have to fight them at the end. And we have a tough time doing this because these people put on the books laws that is supposed to be in the favor of its own people. But they keep breaking it. They make deals, they make laws to govern its own people, then they misuse it, they break it. And they give you certain things. Then you have to fight like hell to keep it. We as indigenous people of the world always had that problem with our own governments. In 1975, when we started this thing, there were laws on the books, especially from the Canadian government. If you call them as government, that there was a Chief Justice called Thomas Berger, had an inquiry. And under that direction of that inquiry, he set up adjoining the Arctic Wildlife Range, set up International Park, which favors the Porcupine Caribou. We had all these things and went to Congress, but we couldn't do nothing as a whole because we were not an organization. And then in 75, that same year, I forget the name of that outfit. United Nations met in Stockholm to discuss indigenous people of the world. At the end, they made a statement which the Canadian government and the United States government signed off on. And today you ask the Whaling Commission, what is your credential? I say to you and to the people of the world, under the United Nations direction, agreed upon in Stockholm in 75, that I am an indigenous people. I belong to that area. That is a credential make me what I am today. My credential is under that when they said that people of the world or countries or not or nations cannot step on the way in the way of the indigenous people to practice their way of life, their religion, or their language. countries and nations must step aside for these indigenous people to practice that. And that is our credential, because the United Nations said so. Under that, in 1982, the village in the Yukon Flat and the village of Katuvik and Mayo, Dawson, Old Crow, and CYI, as representative of the Yukon people, indigenous people, met in Arctic Village. And we formed what is known today as the International Porcupine Caribou Commission. And we filed it with the United Nations. We did not file it with the United States, we filed it with the United Nations under their agreement in Stockholm. And that's how the International Porcupine Caribou Herd Caribou Commission became an existent. From there, we started moving. And last October, the governor of the state of Alaska called us into his office and said, "You guys been working on this caribou treaty for many years." He says, "About time we move on with it." And he formed the task force. And today, with the Fish and Game of the state of Alaska, we have worked out the wording. And today, as Steve informed me, that now the deputy commissioner, will be meeting with the Fish and Wildlife people from the feds. And sometime this year, before this year is over, the Native people of the commission will meet in Vancouver to decide what steps we'll take from that point on. And that's where we are with the International Porcupine Commission. And if I may, I want to point out, like I said yesterday, I was pretty disgusted, but I'm not today because I'm hearing from my own people. And this is a roundtable discussion should come from the people that we are talking about. We say we're subsistent people. I am a subsistent person. I am a tribal government brought up that way under the IRA Council. When the state of Alaska talked to us, they must talk to us on equal basis, because the state of Alaska was created with a constitution. My tribal government was created by a constitution. We don't have a bylaw, we have a constitution. So we must be talked together, if we talk to each other, must be on equal basis. My constitution says that anybody is going to represent me must have a piece of paper from the chief of my tribe or a resolution from my council. I carry that because I am the chief. Nobody else has got that authority. Just like I don't have authority to represent the state of Alaska. The governor does. And we talk about all these things, saying that when it comes down, who owns the right to live the right of their ancestors? I inherited that, being born an Indian. I inherited a lot of rights because as we talk about these animals, the other 2 days ago I was home. When we talk about an animal where the native people of the world are in the same ecosystem with these animals. We are not a visitor upon these lands. We are in the same ecosystem as the animal on these lands because we take care of it. If there's going to be an danger, obstacle in a way, we try to solve it. 2 days ago, if you heard, in northern Quebec, 10,000 caribou drowned because somebody forgot to level the river before the crossing of these animals. The caribou, as my people believe for many years, is part of the Kuchin people religion. We kill it, we eat it, we use their parts of their fur and stuff for our own clothing. But we also believe that the population of the Kuchin people in the Yukon Flat goes up and down with the numbers of these animals. If the porcupine caribou herd decline, and that it's our people believe that our people will decline. This is why it's very important to us when we talk about the porcupine caribou herd, that it be protected for our generations to come, because this is our belief. Way back in the 1920s, the porcupine caribou herd was 250,000 strong. So was our people. In the early 40s, the porcupine caribou declined to around 110,000. Our people declined in the early 1940 with a sickness called the flu to that number. We see it through our own culture of everything we're saying, that it is the truth as we know it, as we've been told. When I talk to a bunch of people, I get nervous. I'm kind of shaky right now because I indulged myself last night with the culture at hand. Putting that aside, when you come to my part of the country, I expect you to respect that culture at hand. If there's any question, I would like to take it now and expand it on certain other areas at the end of this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Solomon. You indicated you'd be willing to answer some questions now, and then after we've heard from the others, we'll return to you. Well, Woodrow?
I didn't have my hand up, but I will ask a question. I was reading through your statement of June 21st, 1983, that had to do with the Arctic Wildlife Range oil and gas exploration plans, and I want to ask pretty much the same questions that I asked this morning of Marie Adams and Burton Rexford, and it has to do with the problems with the scientific community. In your statement, you said that there was that there were some hearings held on regulations for seismic explorations, and that the people explained to the people holding those hearings how the wind blows the snow off little hills all winter long, and how it, in low spots the snow is real deep, but in the final EIS the statement said there was not enough known about the area, and then you also went on to tell them, or to ask the question, why don't you believe that the people explained to you all this, why don't you believe them? You take the words of your scientists and others who come here and visit for a short time, maybe one or two times, maybe more, but you do not believe the people who spend their whole life here. Is this still a problem with those scientists? Do they listen, or?
Yes. The simple reason that these guys come out there to do a survey or whatever, and they fly over the area, but they never take the initiative to ask the expert, like I said yesterday, the people that live there. We tell them, we testify at hearings about numbers, about habitat. Nobody listens. We're just knocking on a wall that won't open because there's no door there. We know, just like the Alaska Whaling Commission knows how many animals out there. We know, we live there every day. But they never take our word for it. They fly over it one time, they're an expert. Just like Mr. Lonnery, an expert in subsistence. And write a book about it. We don't need a book. We know it for generations back.
Any other questions at this stage? Marie Adams.
Yeah, I wanted to find out what happened in Canada. You were referring to you referred to 10,000 caribou that was that drowned.
Victor, you want to take that? I just heard about it 2 days ago. That's in northern Quebec.
Well, maybe Victor Matender of Council of Yukon Indians tell us something about that.
What was the question?
Oh. What happened in northern Quebec with the caribou?
What happened in northern Quebec, I guess, goes back a long ways when the Quebec government put in place plans to build hydro development in northern Quebec. Basically, there's a number of problems that had to be overcome. And I guess basically what happened there is that there was miscalculations on the water flow, and I guess basically the power authorities have released too much water into the water system, and when the caribou came through, they swam across the river there and were caught in the rapids, and that's what happened. The whole herd just went right through. And as a result of that, approximately 10,000 animals were lost in that. And I guess there's been some mistakes that were made in planning the environmental and the to consider the water flows and so forth. And as a result of that, they are pointing their fingers at Quebec Hydro that there should have been proper measures in place. And as a result of that, now they are putting in place a fence that would block or stop the caribou from going that way, and basically forcing them to go and take another route where they can cross safely.
Thank you. Any other questions of Jonathan Solomons? Steve?
Jonathan, the International Porcupine Commission passed a resolution in April laying out a framework for how you think the commission ought to be established and some principles for managing the herd. Could you tell us what has been the response of the state and the federal government to date to the specifics in the commission plan which you guys laid out at that time?
Yes, the state of Alaska, I said, is cooperating finally with the Caribou Commission. We make up the task force for it. And we worked out the wording now it went to public hearing, and now it's going. They're going to meet with the Fish and Wildlife people, but we never approached the federal yet. It's not after we get all these things out of the way, then we go to federal.
Yeah, Woodrow.
When you filed your Caribou Commission with the United Nations, did you file it as a commission, or were you seeking NGO or non-governmental organization status?
No, we filed it as commission under the Indigenous People Rights.
So then, on these international dealings, do you deal directly with the Canadians, or who does the commission deal directly with?
With our brothers on the other side, because we are a sovereign nation. We can deal with other countries.
So then the commission is set up then to affect United States policies and Canadian policies for the management of the herds? Is that what it's for?
Pardon me?
That the commission was established to affect, or would we say develop policies for management of the porcupine caribou herd. Are you trying to get those policies adopted by both the United States and Canadian governments, or?
Are you asking that does the treaty manage the herd?